Welcome to the NQF Serious Reportable Events Steering Committee call. Please note today's call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Peter Angood. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, and hi, everybody. Thanks for finding some time in your busy schedule on short notice to join us for our ongoing discussions about revisions to the Serious Reportable Events Program. We've had good introductory comments on our previous two phone calls, so we will not spend any time on restating those. And I'm hopeful that we'll just jump into our work for the day, and hopefully we'll be able to get through the rest of our serious reportable event list, review some of the lingering discussion around some of the definitions, and then we'll go from there. Before we get started, just a brief comment, though, on as we finish up, hopefully today, if not, we will try to schedule a fourth call to do the final cleanup. But we at NQF are collating all of these comments. We will pull that all into a single document that we will then distribute to the steering committee via SurveyMonkey to have you have the opportunity for some final edits as we draft a report that needs to go up for public comment. And so that'll be the steps in our processes. But this open discussion and deliberation is a pivotal part in this whole process. So with that, I'll turn it over to Greg and Sally to guide us through the next couple of hours. Thank you.
This is Greg. Thank you to all of you for your forbearance on this as we try to move this hopefully across the finish line, if not today, with a second call, which hopefully will be blessedly shorter. So thank you for your continued work on this. And based on a quick conversation we had just a few short minutes ago, we've decided to try to do this, to try to prioritize the discussion today on those issues that we're going to anticipate are going to be the thorniest. So I'm going to make her introductory comments and let Sally lead that off.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. Thanks to everyone who could make it again on the call today. As usual, we appreciate all the hard work you're doing. To get us, we're getting closer, everybody. We're hopefully getting near the finish line. And hopefully we can get through all today, maybe not, but we would like to start off and certainly do up front the discussion around pressure ulcers and then on falls. So the first one is in pressure ulcers that's under care management events, number four, and F. Discussion on that stage three or four pressure ulcers required after admission to a healthcare facility?
From the skilled perspective, we just want to make sure that, I mean, this is a big issue for us, and we're looking for further guidance from the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. But we want to make sure that across settings, everybody's using the same kind of definition and understanding so that as patients move back and forth, we're all on the same page. That's kind of the biggest issue for us.
Can you give an example of how that's fallen apart, perhaps?
Well, it falls apart oftentimes on transitions, and it's all with the transitions. When was the ulcer there? How was it there? What was it staged as? Was it appropriately staged? And, of course, now the issues, of course, are the unstageable ulcers and the stage 3 and 4 that are being combined. So we want to make sure that across settings everybody's using the same definitions and up to speed.
And this is Peter Angood. I could have, should have looked at the current status of an NQF project on pressure ulcers, but we've had some ongoing work for quite some time. As we move forward in this, we'll, as NQF staff, make sure there's a double check against that other project to make sure we're not creating any conflicts or confusions to the field. But I believe the pressure ulcers project that has been going on has spent an awful lot of time on clarifying definitions as well as this issue of transitions.
I'll make another comment. I know the physician office tap didn't say anything about it, but as the years have gone on and our patients become more and more frail, we actually see a lot of pressure ulcers in the outpatient setting. Whether or not they start there is unlikely. But they are much more common than they used to be in home care and in independent settings now.
I guess, this is Stan. The issue for me is the beginning of pressure ulcers and the decision about tissue damage that can occur and then show up later. I guess whenever the ambulatory surgery TAP talked about this, that was one of their issues because it potentially could start in an ambulatory setting and then show up whenever someone subsequently went to the hospital for something. So I think it's an interesting issue that's I would like to know more about in terms of what the other expert panel is doing.
Well, one of the things that's happening right now, because it's such an issue and there's a fair amount of litigation, facilities can afford to have major problems with this. There's a number of devices now that you can use ultrasound and plethysmography to assess for damage that you can't see.
Right.
So this is Duran. I just had a response to the suggested modification number 5 on the master list. In that they are asking for exclusionary language for unavoidable pressure ulcers as defined by the Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. And I just worry that that brings up ambiguity there and that it will then allow each institution to decide whether the standard of care was met or not.
Right.
And will be a major problem for us to really say that we have a process without variation across the country. So I'm actually against that modification. I'm not sure what the answer is here, but people are going to game the system.
Yeah, this is Diane. I completely agree. I would oppose any change that gets into that issue of not reporting pressure ulcers that are considered by a facility to not have been preventable, because we've seen that people definitely have different standards for what's preventable and what's not, and it's a moving target. What we consider preventable today may not have been considered preventable a few years ago. So we tend to deal with it by just acknowledging that not all pressure ulcers are preventable, but we still want them all reported.
Absolutely.
This is Stan. I agree completely because what happens right now is that everybody is just trying to game the system like mad. So I agree with Diane. I think that's a great thing. Of course, that's why we see lots of pressure ulcers reported from Minnesota, and some of the rest of us don't see so many, I guess.
Well, we also report unstageable here, and a lot of states don't. So
this is Martha, and I concur completely with that. It also tend to not mix process and outcome measures because that's what you're doing when you say it's preventable.
Yep. This is Michael. This particular phrasing is very different from a lot of the ones above in that to make it parallel, we would say death or disability of a person with a stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcer that was acquired after admission to a facility only if it came to the attention of that facility by readmittance or if it came to attention by reporting from the family. So this is probably one of the most complex, circuitous, bizarre qualifications that we have. What that does to me is it raises 5 or 6 individual debate topics. And I think we might be able to clarify some of them if we answered this question. Do we want national reporting through this mechanism of all stage 3 or 4 ulcers? And then do we want to qualify that by saying, well, that would be too many. Maybe we could reduce all stage 3 or 4 ulcers, whether they die or not, by some other sub-qualification. But it seems to me like we have too many qualifications on this right now.
I'm not sure I follow you there, that we have too many qualifications on this now.
Well, we got death or disability. I mean, if we were to say this the way the others are, it would be death or disability due to a stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcer acquired after admission to a healthcare facility if you are notified by either readmittance or a call from the family.
So I guess I'm sort of going to come down on Diana's side. I think maybe just the mere presence, if they were required after admission, would be what I would go with rather than death or disability. I think that's a really convoluted. I understand it comports with the way all the rest are written, but I'm not sure that this particular SRE is going to lend itself to that without being really.
You're agreeing with me, and I think throwing out the subtext here, you know, death or disability and reporting by admission, I would just throw that out and see what we have if we just say all patients who acquire a stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcer after admission.
Well, but that's what the event is. The event currently does not have a death or serious disability threshold for reporting.
Oh, I was just reading it.
Is it? I think I was just looking at that too, and it's confusing. I just looked at our statute, which is based on the NQF, and it's not a death or serious disability threshold. I think the language there is a little confusing because it makes it sound like only death or serious disability is reportable, but really I think what that clause is meant to say is that if you become aware of a death or serious disability by readmittance to or from a patient's family, that would be considered the point at which you became aware of the event. But we don't use a severity threshold here in Minnesota.
Well, let me go back. I think you and I are on the exact same point. For many of our, for all of our events, we have a reporting threshold. For some of them, it's death or disability. We were going to call it injury. For others, it's any, you know, kidnapped baby.
Right.
So we could make this either one. My proposal would be to make this reporting threshold any and make the definition of the event a patient who develops a 3 or 4 after admission.
Well, maybe we need a little clarity from NQF, because now I'm sort of questioning. I know that for our state, they are reportable. Any stage 3 or 4 required after admission is reportable and unstageable. We do not have a death or serious disability threshold, but...
Yeah, we don't either.
Now I'm trying to remember if we made a modification to the NQF standards on that. I don't think we did. I don't think the event currently has a threshold by severity.
It does not.
Okay.
So can we toss this confusing language here? That would help me enormously. You know, death from a pressure ulcer is a tricky diagnosis anyway.
So the proposal, this is Greg. So the proposal would be for it to read any stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcers acquired after admission to a healthcare facility, period.
Yeah.
It's Peter Angood. I think that does help us, and it certainly alleviates the confusion. The previous committee was obviously trying to have some continuity of language through all of the SREs, but...
And there was another issue, Peter, as well, with the previous committees, and that was that this was being done, I think, in the context of the language of, quote, never events. And to the extent that we've moved beyond that language here, I think the comfort level, I think, increases dramatically.
Yeah, I think this is quite helpful.
Yes. No, and good move on the committee.
It's erroneously placed on that table, so it was not in the 2006. That language you're suggesting come off, should come off, it wasn't there.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look that up, too, so someone beat me to it.
Yep.
Now, this is Michael again. If that's sort of tentatively done, then I would address the non-hospital settings in this way by saying anyone who diagnoses one of these things in their setting ought to report it or not. In the ambulatory setting, I used to see these from time to time, and you would see a patient either brought in from a nursing home, or you'd go there, or you'd have a patient who's during home care brought into the office when they get there in heart failure or something, and you see this horrible ulcer, and you send them to the hospital. Do we want to collect reports where we don't know where the patient was, where it originated, but we're diagnosing a bad ulcer?
Not sure how that helps anyone.
Yeah.
Well, so then, okay, and I have no dog in this race, but it seems to me then we have a pretty crisp delineation that if, never mind never events, but if we talk about a serious reportable event, that means in your facility, if the patient develops one of these things, you should report it. On the other hand, we don't want every report of every ulcer in America if we don't know where it developed. Is that right?
See, this is Goshal, and I think that's an interesting question, only because if, in fact, we don't want you to report that stage 3 or stage 4 when you see it, in my mind, we are presuming that the facility where that individual resides has done the reporting. Because if it's a serious reportable event, in my mind, it needs to be, they all need to be reported,
well,
but only once.
You know, this is Stan. I think the at least for an ambulatory surgery setting, for instance, it's going to be really fairly complicated because you know, you may end up with some little lady from the nursing home who comes to say have a central venous line placed and is there just a few seconds, and I'm not sure if everybody's going to sort of roll her over and check and see if she has a pressure ulcer or not. So I think it's going to be really hard to implement if we say that. So I'm just wondering if we really do want every...
I mean, I hear you completely, Stan. I just think it is a really tricky and tough question. And in your example, if you were placing a central venous catheter in someone who has a stage 4 pressure ulcer, might be good to know that, because the chances
of
a bacteremia are something that, I mean, these things are all interrelated, but I agree completely that we have to have bounds on what we're expecting people to do.
Well, this is Michael. I don't want to be devilish here, but thinking like a plaintiff's attorney, what I would ask you, if that happens, you know, oh, she came in, we put the line in, we sent her home, we didn't realize her back was necrotic. What the plaintiff's attorney would ask is, are you kidding me? You know, like, it wasn't your responsibility to kind of look her over, and she passed through your care with this horrendous factor, and you did, you know, you get the drama here. So although I'm not sure how I vote, I do believe that if we say we're only collecting ones where it developed under our care, but we're not going to report it, the patient just passes through and we notice it, you know, that sounds to me a little bit contrary to the goals of medicine.
So if you look at my health system's issue with our patient as an example, we are a high outlier right now for pressure ulcers on that PSI. And if you look at our data, we've only had two that were here that were on our watch. All the others were present on admission. And we're getting penalized because we do a very good job in turning people over and, in fact, documenting that they're present on admission. But because it's coded by the ARC software in such a fashion that they can't recognize the difference between COA and what's nosocomial, we're looking like a high outlier, which is terrible. So, I mean, from a cleanness of the data perspective, to not obfuscate, you know, which ones really are on our watch, I would vote for really keeping it as those that develop in your facility and really get people to do a better job.
So am I the only person hearing horrible static? I'm having a hard time.
No, this is Goshal. I was just going to type the same message.
Okay.
Yeah, this is almost tempted to dial back in.
Yeah.
Well, just hang on a second.
Maybe we can check with the operator and take an alert.
Operator.
Yeah, let me see. There's several noise coming from several lines, so I'm going to have to kind of mute them one at a time to see if I can't find out where that's coming from. So.
All right, thank you. In the meantime, I would suggest we continue to try to talk through it while he does his work in the background.
Right. So this
it went away.
No.
Okay, I think that's coming from Martha's line.
It's back.
Yeah, that's Martha, that's coming from your line. Is there any way I can get you to dial back in?
Hello?
Martha, that appears to be coming from your line. Can I get you to dial back in?
Martha Radford, if you could dial back in, that would be helpful. Seems to be localized to your line. All right. Why don't we try to continue with our discussion then?
Did everyone hear the point I was trying to make through the static?
I think it would be best to try and get our momentum back if you repeated it shortly,
yeah,
as best you could.
So this is Duran. Just the issue of the PSI from AHRQ, we are a high outlier in my health system because that software does not do a good job in differentiating POA, present on admission, with nosocomial. So the attribution of those pressure ulcers are to my institution, which is driving us a little crazy because that's publicly reported. And I think, as we indicated on the first conference call two times ago, we need to think about the negative ramifications of these definitions. So I would vote that we would really be careful on the attribution issue, make sure that we capture only those that are on our watch as a facility, because otherwise you're going to have lack of clarity over the really who's responsible for these pressure ulcers. And so that would be my vote to really keep it as is, as opposed to reporting all pressure ulcers.
Well, this is Eric, and I'm glad we got the discussion started. I'm going to have to go now. My apologies.
Hi, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah.
So as it stands right now, it would read any stage 3 or 4 pressure ulcers acquired after admission to a healthcare facility. Does anyone have a problem with that going forward?
So you're saying having it go forward unchanged?
Going on forward, the only addition was that we I think putting the word any just to remind people.
Oh, okay.
But that's it. The only other thing that comes up is that issue of what do we do with, where do we stand with unstageable?
Yeah, I think there's also the DTI question that came up, and I know I've heard a lot about from facilities in our state about inclusion of suspected deep tissue injuries. But I mean, we already report unstageable. It feels like the guidance from the NPUAP is pretty clear that an unstageable pressure ulcer is by definition a full thickness wound, which is the rationale we used for reporting unstageable. You know, if it's later determined for some reason it becomes stageable and it's not a stage 3 or 4, a facility can always pull it out. But we switched to reporting unstageables 2 or 3 years ago, and it definitely led to a jump in the reporting of events, but everyone's gotten used to it now.
I would heartily concur with that. This is Martha.
Okay.
That has my vote too, Michael.
Stan, I think so. Well,
so and then the only other piece that we didn't talk about is number 4. This is Duran again, which is consider a separate category of pressure ulcers that are device related due to casts, splints, etc. I'm not sure where I fully stand on that, other than to think we should probably just keep it as is.
Yeah, I would keep it as is. It feels like with a lot of these events, you could easily break things out by how the event happens, and we don't do that. You know,
yeah.
The device-related is just still a pressure ulcer. It's just a different way that it happened.
Okay, and I think that leaves it cleaner.
Yep.
Yeah, that seems reasonable to me.
Okay. So the change would be we would include the unstageable. People feel the same way about deep tissue injury?
I am by no means a pressure ulcer expert. The word that I had gotten from the pressure ulcer experts in our state is that we should not include suspected DTIs, because I'll have to look back at what they sent me about language around this. But I think it was mostly about the fact that unlike other pressure ulcer stages, by definition, suspected deep tissue injuries are suspected and not confirmed. Generally, they'll progress, and you'll be able to stage them as a 3 or 4 or unstageable or something else. But at the point when they are a suspected deep tissue injury, it feels like to us like that's really something different. But I'm not enough of an expert in that area to be more definitive than that.
This is Peter Angood, and I would support that in trying to keep us out of the realm of subjectivity as best possible.
Exactly.
Great.
The suspected deep tissue injury plops you right in the middle of it all. So I'd support not going there.
So not going that direction. Okay.
Yeah, this is Michael. We don't have other suspected events.
Yep.
You know, suspected kidnapping of a baby, but we're not really sure.
Okay. Point well made. Further comments on pressure ulcers?
Greg, the outpatient tap or the physician office tap suggested that it did not apply. Does the group agree that it would not apply in physician offices?
I do agree that it doesn't apply. I mean, it's at this point in history, I think that you get into attribution issues around pressure ulcers and, you know, family care and things like that.
Not unless your waiting time is really awful.
Right. Good point.
Okay. Great.
This is Sally. I'm going to throw out something on a completely consumer, non-clinical piece of trivia. I had spoke to the head of healthcare quality for Rand Corporation at some point, and he had, for some reason, been in touch with the medical examiner's office, who had been involved with the postmortem for President Reagan. And as you all remember, he had end-stage Alzheimer's and had been bedridden for the last several months of his life. They couldn't even get him up in a chair. But he said it was remarkable that there was no skin breakdown, no sign anywhere of any pressure ulcer, even though he had been fully bedridden for several months. So I guess, you know, I mean, I know the guidelines say 100% chance of pressure ulcers if immobile, but certainly that would be the gold standard of care. So hopefully we can move closer to that for everybody.
That's good.
Hey, Sally, which should we tackle next?
I think falls is what people are also anticipating might have some discussion around it. That would be environmental events 5, and I think that's D under environmental events is patient death or serious disability associated with a fall while being cared for in a healthcare facility. And the TAPS.
This is Stan. Our TAP was concerned about the location of the fall, at least in ambulatory surgery centers. You know, they're not likely to fall off the stretcher, although that's a possibility. But they might, you know, fall as they're getting out of the wheelchair to get into their car. That would be on the sidewalk. So we were concerned about falls and location.
This is Tejal. Sorry, I had to join late. Our group was similar to Stan in that the location of where the fall happened was the concern. And so you can see where we put, you know, something about patient in being in the care of the team in some way, because, you know, the parking lot outside the building and other places were what people were concerned about.
We have this issue we haven't fully clarified and may not be able to about what under care means. And even in the hospital, because there's that zone of, you know, under, inner, outer, the vestibule, the parking lot, the ramp, I don't think I know a way of resolving it, but I do think that we have a reporting threshold here, which is death or serious injury, and it seems to me that if we can just leave it as while being cared for, I don't know a better way than to say, yeah, that sounds serious enough that if they fall off the stretcher in my office, you know, that and they die, I guess that's reportable.
Hi, this is Stan again. So I guess the issue then goes for what we see is people want to parse things, and I like what Diana and the folks at Minnesota have done. We get arguments all the time that, you know, a hip fracture is not actually a serious disability because after all, they're going to get over it. They're going to be rehabbed. They're going to be able to walk again. So what makes that a serious disability? But I like the way Minnesota has defined it. So I like that as implementation guidelines anyway.
Yeah, we've actually gotten the opposite pushback, which is, well, this patient wasn't able to walk anyway, and so a hip fracture wasn't a disability for them because it didn't lower their activities beyond the level they were already at.
Yeah.
Well, this is Michael. I hate to bring it up constantly, but I really hope we agreed last time that we were going to get rid of disability and replace it with injury and then have debates over what an injury is.
I think we did, yeah. I don't know if we had come to that full agreement on that, but it certainly seemed that that was the way we were headed.
Yeah, this is Greg. My sense was from that first call that we had kind of settled in on the Minnesota definition, which takes care of this issue. I think the only thing we did not, at least in my mind, come to complete closure on is disability versus injury. I'm relatively agnostic about it, but I think that in either case, we'd want to be consistent throughout the document.
This is Stan. I think they're equally difficult to define.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think injury is a little bit easier because disability does raise that question of long-term impact in a way that injury does not. But, yeah, even switching to injury isn't going to really solve our problem. I think it makes it a tiny bit easier to address.
Yep, this is Chris, and I would agree. I think injury is a slightly better term.
So injury, we'll add the definition that we discussed prior that Minnesota uses.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Are people okay with that? I know it had gone out to the group, but we hadn't really explicitly discussed the details of our recommendation on serious disability.
Actually, we had some discussion at the end of the first call.
We did, okay.
Yeah, I think it advances the discussion. You know, it's not perfect, but it's better.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Okay. Hey, can I get back to one issue? And I guess this, again, it would be great to hear from Diane and from Stan, and it gets around this issue of kind of where the facility starts and ends. Has that been a big issue for you, or hasn't it? That's the, you know, the fall on the way out the door, the fall in the parking lot, the fall going through the door, coming back home.
It has been an issue for us, not a major one among the issues that we struggle with. When it has come up, it has been more in the context of ambulatory settings. Partly just the physical space of, you know, what counts as part of someone's license and is a hospital-based clinic, you know, a part of the hospital, what if it's located off-site? We've had those questions. We have had a couple of cases where there have been falls in an ambulatory surgical center setting where it has come up. It's certainly not been in our top 10 of issues that we've struggled with, but it is there.
And hi, this is Stan. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on.
Go ahead.
The issue for us on this, where it occurs, happens for infusion centers, particularly cancer infusion centers, where people walk out the door and then they have some fall and they may, you know, have a broken bone from it. But, you know, we sort of don't get that unless we get a complaint from a patient who says, you know, I was 5 feet from the door, and as I was getting out of the wheelchair or as I was getting into my car, I fell. And, you know, they've just gotten an infusion of chemotherapy. So that's the issue that we see, actually, more than just a little.
Well, this
maybe we have more infusion centers here. I'm not sure.
But, you know, if it's really an issue, I think my sort of bias here, it's a bias, is that I don't feel like I'm here to protect institutions by allowing them to have these little technical gotchas to say, you know, nyah, that wasn't us. If I really were interested in safety, I'd be interested in looking at the gaps where injuries occur and then challenging everybody to say, well, yeah, I don't know whose fault it is, but if people fall down and break their arm in infusion centers a lot, shouldn't someone care?
Yeah, I agree, Michael.
Yeah, this is great. I think the issue. I think if we make the decision that this applies across all the settings, I think we've taken care of that. I think the broader issue is going to be, again, is where kind of does that facility, where does the facility, whether it's an infusion center, or a hospital, or ambulatory surgical center, where does that facility's kind of
boundaries, yeah,
end?
Yeah.
That's the tough part. You know, from a patient perspective, you know, whether or not if they fall, you know, walking up their front driveway after they are hypotensive as a result of the treatment they got in an infusion center, they would prefer, in their mind, they would say, yes, this was related to my treatment.
Right.
But I think it's just where can we practically draw a line that will be that we can try to get some uniformity in reporting.
So, to stand again, boundaries of the facility to me would actually just be until the patient got in their car. You know, and I don't know if that's reasonable or not, or if that's something that we can certainly talk about that one way or another. But at least for ambulatory surgery centers, that would be what I would suggest.
I think it needs a little more thought because some of them, you know, don't have a car.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. I mean, you're exactly right. So I guess the word would be, you know, they're transferred.
It's on the property of the licensed facility?
Yeah, property of the licensed facility. That would be good. That would be better.
Although that raises questions on the front end. You know, we actually had a fall a few years ago where it was someone in the parking lot before they checked in.
Yeah.
The facility. And so if you're going to extend it to the property of a facility on the way out the door, you can't really do that on the way in the door. We've tried to look more. We don't have a final definition on this. We've tried to look more at when do you come under the care of somebody? When have you talked to somebody or seen somebody who was in the facility, part of the care team, as the starting point? We don't have a clean ending point yet, but it feels like it needs to be the point at which you are no longer under anyone's care, but I don't know how you define that in a standard way.
This is Greg. I think that point about, you know, somebody falling on their way in the door, I think that's well taken. But how would it work if we said patient death or serious disability associated with fall either during or after being cared for in a healthcare facility while on the licensed facility's property?
I like it.
I think it's helpful. I think there will still be questions about what it means to be being cared for.
This is Sally. Just a practical question, logistics. I don't know. Every healthcare facility I've been in has always had someone to escort me or the patient, basically until you get to the, I guess, the car, the taxi, whatever will be. Is that standard in all of your facilities that someone is – you've got an orderly with someone, or are people just walking out on their own?
Everything happens. Everything.
Yeah, for ambulatory facilities.
And I have a problem with licensed and premises and stuff like that because I worked in a medical office that I leased from a holding company that was partially owned by a hospital and by a management company that had an elevator. And, you know, God, come on. So I think to a certain extent that we might, and I would almost suggest taking this offline. I would think that we have a problem here with the definition of under care. And I don't feel like all I can see is now a multiplication of reasons why I don't have a good definition. But I know the point here.
Yeah, I think your suggestion to take it offline is maybe a good one. I know we still have a number of events we want to cover, and I think we could spend the whole time talking about this.
Sure.
Maybe there's a small group that could work on coming up with a definition and share with the group via email or on a subsequent call if we have another.
I'm just wondering for Peter and for Melinda, are there any precedents with other NQF groups that have had to tackle this issue about location?
It's Peter, and I'll certainly ask Melinda's help as well. Not that I am aware of, but we can certainly ask around a little bit more. And in my own thoughts on this, I think to help, there needs to be some delineation of when the patient registered with that provider or facility and when the provider or facility discharged or released that patient. Because as we know, there's kind of gray areas between what's medical care versus what's a legal definition. Are they in their care? And just because you're out in the parking lot doesn't mean you're still part of the care provider's responsibility. But
you know, I could also pose a question to the other states that have reporting systems and see if they, if any of them have definitions. Peter, I think a number of the states that were on the call yesterday, yeah, we already participate in a listserv, and that might be a good vehicle for posing.
Yeah, if you could do that, Diane, that'd be good. Melinda, did you have any other comment?
The only other comment was in the tax discussion, they had suggested that we take a look at the EMTALA definition. So there is an EMTALA definition of campus. So if there's a group that's going to look at that, you might want to look at that definition as well.
So who wants to be on the subgroup that's going to come up with some recommendations and bring it back to the full group? Diane said she's going to get other state definitions.
Yep.
Who else wants to be on the subgroup?
Hi, this is Stan. I'd like to be.
Excellent.
Yeah, and this is Diane. I'd like to be part of the group. Mm-hmm. And I'll pass along what I hear from other states.
Anybody else besides Diane and Stan? Just.
Well, we'll send an email prompt to others if they want to get engaged as well.
Okay, so we'll wait to hear from you all, table that for now. And I think the group also anticipated that around criminal events there may be some discussion. So do we want to try to move to number six, criminal events, and hopefully just take them in order, move, plow through those, and then go back and pick up perhaps the less discussion-worthy?
Good.
Okay. Criminal events. The first one under criminal events is any instance of care ordered by or provided by someone impersonating a physician, nurse, pharmacist, or other licensed health care provider.
So this is Greg. I think just to start the conversation off, I think the crux of the issue with this entire category is going to be whether or not redundancy in reporting, meaning that you would have to report these SREs, and oh, yes, indeed, you ought to be reporting these to criminal authorities as well, whether or not that's of value and that's important versus saying, you know something, there is a mechanism to deal with these, that's the criminal justice system, and we should rely on that. I think that's the crux of the debate, and I think that carries across the group. I would be interested if any of the TAPs had that particular conversation and where they came out.
This is Stan again. I think that our TAP would, for the most part, we had the discussion and we, for the most part, agreed that there are other avenues to report these kind of events.
Hi, this is Tejal. We didn't actually go into whether we should remove the whole list of criminal events. I mean, we felt like these were obviously relevant to ambulatory, but didn't actually sort of discuss the option of removal per se. But personally, I do agree with the concept of removing them.
This is Peter, and because Eric's had to leave, the SNF group also talked about it, and Melinda again, keep me honest on this one, but I think they recommended, since there was other reporting for these as specific criminal events, they would not be opposed if they got removed.
This is Michael again. I don't know if I have a vote on this yet, but it occurs to me that the criminal justice system does not handle these things as safety events and doesn't do a root cause analysis the way an organization would that was interested in safety. The criminal justice is interested in something completely different, and definitely not prevention. Although I have some other problems with this particular one of impersonation, I don't necessarily have an a priori reason why, just because the police are called, we shouldn't also look at this from a safety analysis standpoint.
Well, a fair amount of the discussion that I'd heard through the TAPS, as well as in the state-based reporting initiative that we have, is the multiplicity of reporting, the burden of reporting, et cetera, and oftentimes, even if these events occur, they tend not to get reviewed that critically because the default is towards, well, it's a criminal event, and so let the powers that be in the criminal justice side look after the issues. Your point's well taken, Michael. It's a matter of trying to strike a balance for the organizations in terms of whether or not we keep this in. Clearly, it's a serious issue. It's just how it's best managed.
This is Sally, and I guess I would really concur with Michael there. When you talk about venues for reporting other, if you're just talking about the criminal justice system, then I would not necessarily think that should preclude us from reporting from the healthcare setting as well, because that addresses something totally different in terms of your process and whether there was a lapse or omission in process that allowed any event to occur. I think it warrants. I wouldn't worry about the double teaming on reporting on this one. But.
Michael, again, just to raise a perverse question, is it a little disingenuous to say that we're going to have a gigantic burden of reporting of these criminal events because they're so common it would just be annoying?
These are rare. I mean, speaking from our perspective in Minnesota, these are very rare. We usually have, for all of the criminal events in a given year, we only have a handful. We've struggled with defining some of these, particularly with physical assault. How do you get at questions of intent? Because we've had cases where there's been an injury to a patient or staff member from, for example, a patient with traumatic brain injury who lashes out and injures someone, and is that assault or is that just an accidental injury? But regardless of those questions, they are very, very rare.
So this is Stan again. At least from a regulator standpoint, we usually have these events reported to the board by the authorities.
And I think in Minnesota, these events are reported under the Vulnerable Adults Act usually anyway. So they're not just reported as criminal events, but there's generally an investigation done by our regulatory branch of the department in any case, outside of whatever happens through the criminal justice system.
Right.
Well, Diana, I understand that about assault and abduction maybe, but the one that I'm troubled with is this first one now is the impersonation, because I think it's too vague for me.
Yeah.
Is that also reportable under some other thing you know about, a vulnerable adult thing?
To be honest, we have never had one of those reported in the 7 years we've been doing this, and so I don't have a whole lot of expertise on it. I would imagine that, actually, I don't know if that would be reportable to the boards, because if the person is impersonating a provider, they're not going to be subject to board discipline. That one would probably just be a criminal justice event.
Hi, this is Stan again. Actually, impersonating a physician is a disciplinary act in Massachusetts.
Oh, there you go.
That means you can hold yourself out just by saying that I'm a doctor.
Well, I think every state has a practicing medicine unlicensed kind of a crime, but
it's not about necessarily unlicensed. It's just about
representing yourself.
Representing yourself.
Impersonation. Yeah, there may be a dozen statutes. It could be fraud too. The thing is, I would think this is the most common of all the things in the world. When we see crimes here, that mostly the drug crimes, it's typically some nurse calling in some Vicodin for herself, or that sort of thing. The part of the reason I have trouble with A here, the impersonation one, is because the line that tries to differentiate between the misunderstanding of a medical student that says, "Hi, I'm Dr. Jones," And the patient that says to the PA, Dr. Jones, you know, and nurse, and the mid-level and so on, and the person lets that ride, or because it's a misunderstanding, and an actual, you know, the fraudulent obtaining of services by someone because of deliberate impersonation. And you know, so we're sort of into a trial mode here. I don't have trouble with something wrong here when you have, you know, a person that comes in and gives an injection because, you know, and your facility didn't have the ability to see if that was an authorized person. But that isn't quite what this says.
Yeah, this is Goschel, and on that very first one, I unfortunately have had experience, not at Hopkins, but before I came here, with someone who was not only impersonating being a physician, but had several years of great practice in other facilities as a non-physician impersonator. And for me, the sticking point for A is that it says an instance of care, I just lost the screen, the instance of care provided, let me see.
Ordered by or provided by.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not that I'm holding myself out as a physician saying I'm Dr. Smith. It's when I actually provide care or issue orders as a provider. And I mean, I agree. I think these things are egregious, and they do represent safety issues. So,
I just thought of another issue.
Okay.
When you're doing the impersonation, the criminal justice system attacks you.
Right.
But this event is really aimed at institutions and facilities. Never mind that someone came in and parked in the doctor's lot and then did a tonsillectomy. The criminal justice will take care of them. My problem is with you.
Right.
What kind of an institution is it where someone walks in and does a tonsillectomy, you know, and you don't have a way of watching for that? So for me, the safety aspect of institutional process here is what's important. It's not that some criminal came in and did something. You're supposed to stop that.
Correct. I agree.
So where does that leave us?
Well, it's Peter, yeah. In terms of NQF and revising this list, we need to get off the pot, so to speak.
Right.
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like we have consensus to remove this as an event. That's not what I'm hearing.
I'd be inclined to keep it on the basis that, number one, it's extremely infrequent, so it would be not a reporting burden. And secondly, I think the legal pathway results in different outcomes than quality improvement pathways in terms of looking for system failures and changing the system.
Michael, I vote to keep it, but I would propose to change the language just a little to say an incidence of care ordered or performed in the facility by someone. This separates that issue of someone used your telephone to call something into the pharmacy.
Doesn't sound like you're getting a big rise out of that one, Mike.
Nope. Cancel that. Just leave. You know, maybe I think I hear us leaving it.
My comment was going to be, sorry, that, I mean, we have a great group and we debate and dissect well, but some of these topics, sometimes we're just better off leaving them as is because the field's comfortable with it already.
Yeah, and this kind of reminds me of the conversation we had around suicide and do we need to define a facility or a setting and what about care being provided in the community. And after a lot of debate, we ended up leaving it as is. This kind of feels the same.
Okay.
Agree.
So can we
agree
that
with that?
Okay. Okay. So that's a group recommendation, leaving A as is.
Yep.
Okay. Let's move on to B, which is abduction. The TAPs want to comment first?
I think our comment was simply that it was relevant to ambulatory surgery. And I think the strange example that we came up with was that a family member came to pick up a patient who was not yet discharged and was, you know, that was a sort of a out on the fringes kind of example.